But tonight, my guests at the big table have been fighting for equality for about a half a century, if not longer. Fred and Mike Klonsky have been active members of Chicago's progressive political community, as well as taking part in the protest movement here in Chicago. Both are active in advocating for better schools, as Fred is a former teacher and a former local teachers union president. Mike's a former secretary for the Students for a Democratic Society, the famed student group at the heart of the anti-Vietnam protests back in the late 60s. Today, they're both prolific writers, both blogging daily, and it is my pleasure to welcome both to the Download, the brothers together, Fred and Mike Klonsky, here on the Download. Good to see you guys. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for having us, Justin.
You know, it's great. I'm trying to get you guys on the show. I think it's apropos we're talking here on Martin Luther King Day. Talk about this holiday for you guys, both of you that spent time in you know, the civil rights movement, trying to sort of advocate and protest against the powers of P. Talk about it. Mike, what's it mean to you? What does Martin Luther King Day mean to you?
Well, one of the things that stands out to me about Dr. King is after he died, the media and the powers that be tried to turn him into kind of like a harmless icon. But to me, Dr. King was a revolutionary figure. And the thing that I really loved about him was that he, when he was asked about different politicians, who he supported. And his response was always the same. No matter who was elected, which party, his place would be out in the streets with the people. And, you know, that's what kind of inspired me. I came here, I moved to Chicago in 1968, the year that Chicago was in great turmoil, and about a few weeks after Dr. King was assassinated. And my wife and I packed up all our belongings and came from Los Angeles, because I was elected to be the National Secretary of SDS, and our national headquarters was here on Madison Street. And I remember pulling into our new digs, our staff apartment on West Warren in 1968, and there were National Guard troops everywhere, tanks rolling up Madison Street, barbed wire, and we would sit up on the roof of the SDS office and watch the West Side burning in flames. And, you know, this was the power of Dr. King and the anger people felt.
Yeah,
when he was assassinated.
Fred?
Well, you know, I was on the internet today, and I was kind of stunned that when I saw a tweet from the Federal Bureau of Investigation honoring Martin Luther King on the anniversary of his birth, and because I remember when the FBI didn't exactly have a close personal relationship with Dr. King, except in the sense that they spied on him, bugged his phone calls, listened in on his bedroom conversations with his wife, tried to the director of the FBI, Herbert Hoover, identified him as the most dangerous Negro in America.
J. Edgar Hoover,
And tried to get him to kill himself, I think is what came out in the COINTELPRO stuff. So this idea—it's gotten to the point where he's been turned into this this kind of plastic saint, like you would put on the dashboard of your car when I was a young kid.
Almost respectability, like this idea. And I read a story about that today. That the Black Lives Matter movement right now is a little bit perturbed at the—if that's the word I'd use—but that they are, you know, sort of, why can't you be more like the Dr. King movement? You know, and there is a little bit of head scratching when it comes to revisionist history,
That's
the way
exactly
that
right.
the history books are written. Yeah.
Yes, and so we like the radical Dr. King, and that's what he really was. He was a radical. He would say time and time again that if peace means we have to live as second class citizens, if peace means live under segregation, then I don't want any part of it.
You know? Why do you think that his legacy or even the memory of Dr. King has changed over time? Why do you think when you talk about that sort of, you know, the plasticizing or the idea of like almost cleaning up his image, where does that come from?
That's the power of this system. I mean, this is a powerful system with great ideological hold on people. And, you know, in this country, we're fortunate that the government doesn't rule by naked force all the time. You know, it also rules by the ideological hold it has on us, and it has the power to reframe images and conversations and how we look at people. And that's what I mean.
It's also about how, you know, who gets to tell the story, who gets to tell history, and who gets to tell the story. So we were talking to a young woman today, and we were mentioning that that my brother was National Secretary of Students for a Democratic Society, and she looked at us kind of blankly. I said, "Well, this was the largest anti-war student organization in the history
People
of the United States.
Yeah.
Hundreds of thousands of members and campuses all across the country. But who knows this story? Who knows this story today? Who gets to tell that the story of what happened in 1968 or in 1963?" So, part of the way the system works is to get control of the narrative and get control of who tells the story.
I'll give you another example like that. I used to work over at Paul Robeson High School on the South Side. And do you know who Paul Robeson?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would ask my graduate students at DePaul every year when they would come in, do you know who Paul Robeson was? And only about two or three of them knew. But all the young kids at the high school students at Robeson High School all knew.
It is interesting, the history or who's telling the history.
So I would ask them, I would say, well, now, what if that question was on the standardized test that determined who graduated, who got to college, and how many of you would be here right now, and how many of those kids who don't ever get in here would make the cut? You
know? Mike Klonsky, Fred Klonsky, the Klonsky brothers, can I call you that?
Sure.
That's okay. That's
brothers Klonsky, like Karamazov.
There you go. In studio tonight, the big table. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk a little bit about that history, talk about the SDS, but also talk about education, because this is a big part of what you guys fight for. And you guys have seen through both of your eyes just the way that, you know, or education has progressed or not progressed over a significant amount of time here in Chicago. Again, Fred and Mike Klonsky in studio with my guests at the big table. Stay with us. Seems like appropriate music for you guys. Like it feels.
I have my hearing aids on, but I can't hear what it is.
Fred and Mike Klonsky in studio. They're my guests tonight at the big table, longtime activists and advocates. Fred was a longtime teacher, also an organizer, a union president.
That's right.
Teachers union president. Also, Mike was the national secretary for the Students for Democratic Society, the SDS, which was a huge student anti-war organization back in the 60s. And you know, I mean, 70s too. I mean, it's tremendous to be able to look back and, you know, just putting your guys in the old internet machine. You know, Mike, and being able to see you with your long hair and your little mustache and, you know, sitting next to, you know, Fred Hampton or Bobby Rush and the Black Panthers. I mean,
I don't think I've changed at all. Do you?
I don't think you've changed.
No.
I'm just getting to know you here. But, I mean, talk about where'd you get your love of politics? Where was it that you started to pay attention to the world around you?
I don't really call it a love of politics. I mean, I guess a part of it is DNA. You know, our parents were radicals. Our dad, when he was a teenager, hitched a ride over to France and hiked across the Pyrenees and was one of the volunteers in the Spanish Civil War, fought against the fascists and Franco in 1936, you know, and came back. It was a lifelong radical revolutionary. And was persecuted very severely during the McCarthy period in the 50s. And so I kind of had a hate relationship with politics growing up because my dad was persecuted and our family went through very tough times at that time. And but the 60s got me, you know, and it wasn't just politics, it was the culture.
The culture,
it
right.
was, you know, and even the late 50s, you know, the Beat Generation and the music and the culture, but it was really the 60s student movement that got me, and especially being able to, you know, when we would turn on the TV in the morning for the first time, we got to see these napalm bombs exploding in Vietnam and villages being destroyed. And then right after that news came images of from Mississippi of the police turning dogs and fire hoses on black folks who were protesting for their rights. And, you know, just being a, not so much a political person, but just being a caring individual, I tried to be, got my blood boiling, and then next thing I knew, I was getting arrested at protests and things like that, and police kind of beat a lot of that into me. And so I wouldn't call it a love relationship exactly, but I've been stuck with it ever since.
How about you, Fred?
Well, you know, I'm much younger than my older brother, and so a lot of my memories of the McCarthy period and what happened to our father, I don't really have those same memories. So for me, I got involved late, really in high school in L.A. at the time. Although 10 years earlier, the U.S. Supreme Court had ruled that school segregation was illegal, that separate but equal schools were illegal. In fact, the Los Angeles School District then, and probably still is a highly segregated school system. And so one of the first things that I was active in was I went to a predominantly white Jewish high school in Hollywood, Fairfax High School, mostly kids of immigrants from Europe, Jewish kids from whose parents had fled Europe, often before the war and some after. Yeah. The Congress of Racial Equality was organizing what they call the study in at the LA Board of Education. And we would organize, impacted us a lot because the system in LA was segregated not like it was in the South, but because the LA School Board had drawn district lines that ensured that some schools would be all white and others would be all black or Chicano.
Like Chicago.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, that sounds things very have familiar, not, right?
Things have, this is what's interesting about the current period to me, is that as terrible as I think the election of Donald Trump is, we've been here before. We've seen this kind of stuff that tries to turn white and black working people against each other. We've been here before, and beat it before. I was talking to Michael, and my memory is terrible. So there's a reporter for the New York Times who's done a study. She calls herself the segregation reporter, and I'll pull up her name for you later. But her point is, in doing the study, is that no single thing impacts the success of poor and non-white students of color more, been successful than integrating the public schools. That's in fact the only thing that has improved the performance, the quality of education for poor and
yet we've seen students
we've of
seen
color.
Institutions and governments go out of their way to
they've tried
to
choice
try,
they've
to keep
tried
that away,
vouchers
right?
They've tried charters, and none of it has worked. The only thing that has worked, and according to these studies, is what we tried to do back at Fairfax High School in 1964, was to redraw the lines so that the schools wouldn't be segregated. And what the studies have shown is that up until about after the Brown versus Board of Education, that up until about 1988, when Reagan ran on his Southern strategy and promised Northern and Southern politicians that they wouldn't have to worry about DSEG orders or attempts by the federal government to integrate the schools, that scores rose for students of color up to 1988. And once segregation began to be reinforced, that those scores declined.
Segregation plays a huge role in Chicago. Mike, I mean, when you take us back to the late 60s, I mean, that was a big part of the inequality and what we saw here in the city of Chicago. And a lot of what was happening with, you know, when you're, it's like you said, you're sitting on the rooftops watching the West Side burn, you know, it hasn't changed since the days that you were out sort of fighting, not only, you know, in 1968, but 1969, Days of Rage.
Well, part of the reason the cities were burning, not just Chicago, it was over 40 cities in flames after Dr. King was assassinated, had a lot to do with the failure of integration. The beating down of the civil rights movement and disempowerment of African-American people here in the northern cities like Chicago. And the tone of the civil rights movement changed from being one of integration to what they call black power. You know, black people saying, well, if you're not going to integrate, we want to have control of our own communities and our own schools. And in 1968, for example, there was big struggles around what was called community control, not just of the schools, but of the police department and of other institutions in the city. And a much more militant leadership arose that replaced Dr. King, that was not nonviolent by any stretch.
This would be the Black Panthers,
that Black Panther Party, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which is kind of ironic. It started out Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. But after King's assassination, it was no longer students. It wasn't nonviolent, and it also wasn't very well coordinated. But that's a joke, you know. But the my point.
My point is that
again, the point I tried to make earlier. We have a slogan: no justice, no peace. You know, so the failure of integration also meant that there was much more discontent, and people weren't willing to live in the old way anymore. And I think what people are really worried about is with the new Trump administration is that there's going to be more civil disorder.
Well, let's get to that. Let's take a break here so we can get an update on tonight's news. And there's a lot to talk about. Mike and Fred Klonsky in studio, both longtime members of the activist progressive political movement here in Chicago, protest movement, former teacher, former treasurer or secretary for the Students for Democratic Society, national secretary. We'll have more with brothers Klonsky here on the show at the big table after the news. Stay with us. Thank you, Rob. Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guests tonight at the big table, Fred and Mike Klonsky, longtime educators, activists, advocates, all the way along. I mean, we're talking everything from, you know, MLK Day, Martin Luther King, to Chicago in the late 60s, to segregation, to education. We're going to talk more about that coming up here. It is interesting. I mean, we a lot of emphasis on the inauguration, a lot of emphasis on protest. And almost, you know, under this guise that it's uncharted territory, we don't know what's going to happen. But you know what? I mean, listening to your stories, listening to the first half of this interview, it does feel like we've been here before.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the young activists who I know, because my kids basically are bewildered. We're thrown for a loop when Trump got elected. It was like their world was coming apart, and they didn't know how to respond. And, you know, because there's such a disconnect between this generation and us and the older generation. But we're very familiar with this, with these kind of threats, you know, with the racist underbelly of this country.
That's right.
This is not a shock to us, you know, when you hear the president talking about, well, this is my black guy over here, or talking about Mexicans being criminals or rapists. You know, I remember when Lyndon Johnson would talk about Dr. King as that N-word preacher. See, that's how he described him. And so, we've been around long enough to remember and to know, and to also know how to resist it. You know, and we resisted it during the, you know, going all the way back to the 50s and 60s. The 50s was a lot of persecution, people hounded by McCarthy, put into prison, lost their jobs. A lot of everybody from writers to actors couldn't work anymore. Then in the 60s, right here in Chicago, you know, you had political assassinations. Fred Hampton shot and murdered in his bed right up here on the west side of Chicago. A lot of very serious repression, something that was called Operation COINTELPRO that was launched by the Federal Bureau of Investigation to harass people who were in the anti-war movement and the protest movement. And we built a resistance movement then. And now we're going to do it again. And you can see people know how to do it. There's going to be a big march, a women's march at the inauguration in protest of, Trump's assault on women's rights and, you know, the kind of culture that he's trying to push. I won't get into the sort of details. Everybody knows
about that.
So yeah, we're familiar with oppression and resistance, and we're on familiar ground here.
Fred, for you, as an educator, longtime teacher, I mean, when you have a background like this, when you talk about the idea of being an advocate or being even involved in politics or in progressive politics, Harold Washington all the way down. Mm-hmm. Do the students that you've seen over your time as you're retired now, but as a teacher, I mean, are they aware of the protest movements that have come before?
No, I know because they're not. Where are they going to learn them from? The notion of a curriculum that's taught in the classroom that evolves out of teachers' own experience. I mean, there are thousands of teachers who have the same kind of experience and background as my brother and I do. Who want to and have to defy the rules in order to tell that story. Instead, what they're expected to do is be like someone who is serving up a Big Mac at McDonald's and deliver what they call the Common Core curriculum, meaning predetermined facts where everybody's supposed to be on the same page on the same day, and where we measure success by a set of standardized tests. So in order to do anything different, teachers essentially have to break the rules and teach from their own experience, from their own lives. Like I say, many of them African American teachers, Latino teachers, and progressive white teachers who went through these experiences will get in trouble. Imagine getting trouble if they teach a curriculum that's based on the things that they care about and know about and have experienced themselves. When I was a young student, a teacher who could come into the classroom and say, "I traveled here, I did that. Here are the stories that I can tell you from my own rich experiences." The students love those experiences. Instead, today, classrooms are being – and when I go back to my friends, which I do now, I taught for 30 years up in Park Ridge, union president up there for 10. When I go back to my and have lunch with my friends, as I do because I'm retired now and can spend lunches doing things like that, but they talk about that, how significantly the atmosphere in classrooms – has changed because not over salary issues or which are important, but over the thing that they came to teaching to do.
Where does that come from?
Let me give you an example, Justin. Today, I got this from the Arizona Republic. Today in Arizona, two representatives, two congressmen, Thorpe and Fincham, introduced House Bill 2120 that prohibits schools and colleges receiving state monies from teaching, quote, social justice or anything that would lead to, quote, division among the races or ethnic groups. So they're passing a law in Arizona that bans teachers from teaching the word social justice or mentioning anything about social justice.
Is it out of fear? Is it out of the idea that people will see the stories of their history and talk about the civil rights movement? I mean, even you see the stories of it's so isolated, but a small town in Mississippi changing the, it's not MLK Day, it's America Day or whatever.
Sure.
But
yeah.
I mean, are we seeing a fear of telling the stories of social justice because that might mean that the people will have the confidence to overturn government?
It's just like we were talking about how the image of Dr. King has changed. There's a cultural war in this country over how to interpret its history. And it has a lot to do with this ideological hold that they have on people. Yes, it's kind of like rebellion insurance. This country was born in rebellion, but... there is fear. There's fear of civil disorder as conditions get worse for people. There's fear of uprising, a revolt, of social change.
Look, when I came to Chicago I moved from Los Angeles here in 1973. And when I came to Chicago in 73, it didn't look like Chicago looks today. Every neighborhood, and I don't mean to make it look like it was paradise, but every neighborhood had a neighborhood public school, a church or some other place of worship, a bar, and a factory. When I first came to Chicago, I got a job not far from where I live in Logan Square now at Stuart Warner up on, it was up on Diversity and Levitt. But this is typical. Neighborhoods all over the city.
The building block, the foundation
it was
of the neighborhood.
It was the industrial base, in fact, that brought hundreds of thousands of African Americans to this city for jobs from the South. And those jobs became, because of struggle, became union jobs, paying union wages. Later, I got a job down at U.S. Steel. I had no, being a 60s guy, I dropped out of college in those days, and so I had no marketable skills whatsoever. But I could go down, like hundreds of thousands of other young people could do, go down to Southworks or Republic Steel or places like that and get a job that paid a union wage, that paid their health insurance. And in those days, that was just when the skilled jobs were opening up to African-American workers and to women. Our union president down at Southworks was the first woman to be the president of a basic steel local anywhere in the United States. So that's what... There's plenty of other things about Chicago that we could talk about, but those things were true, and those things aren't true anymore. We don't have neighborhoods public schools. There are areas of the west side of Humboldt Park where 4 square miles of the city doesn't have a single neighborhood public elementary school, where the factories are gone. There's been a deindustrialization. African-American workers who worked in those jobs are gone, left the city entirely, almost 250,000 African-Americans gone over the last 20 years, left not just the city, but the entire region. And so this creates what my brother was talking about. Yes, it's a question of fear, because if you don't know the history of the city and you don't know the history of struggle that made it look like that, then you don't know your own history.
Let me ask you, I guess the simple question, I guess the best way to kind of end this conversation is just about, do you feel that when it comes to social justice, when it comes to some of the issues that you've been advocating for since the late 60s, or as you mentioned, the 50s, has society gotten better? I mean, have some of these issues that you've been fighting for, have you had victories? Have you seen change?
Yes, of course. Otherwise, I would just be in despair, you know, or... but yes, we've had. I thought I was proud to be part of the civil rights movement, you know, and the great victories we won for voting rights, and equal housing, and public schools. I mean, I've been proud to play a small part in that progress. But what you have now is a rollback of all those gains that we made, all those victories that people gave their sweat, blood, and life for. You know, I'll give you one example. I heard Vice President-elect Pence today defending Trump against his vicious attack on John Lewis, you know, one of my heroes. But of course, he didn't just attack John Lewis. He first praised him in order to attack him. And he said, you know, how could a guy who led the fight for the voting rights bill, you know, say these bad things about the election being rigged and things like that, being illegitimate. And I thought, why is this guy praising the voting rights bill? 2 years ago, the conservative Supreme Court gutted it, gutted the voting rights bill. And if you want to talk about the reasons Trump won this election, I think the gutting of the voting rights bill and depriving so many people of their right to vote out in the states was one of the main reasons for much more so than the Russian, spy thing.
It's just interesting because I guess it says something as we honor Martin Luther King and Martin Luther King Day here in Chicago. A lot of the social issues around social justice and things that you guys have been fighting for your entire life, they're never permanent. Meaning there are this ebb and flow. There's a rollback, or there might be a Supreme Court, a judge that strikes it down, or a movement that changes it. I mean, for you guys, both who have spent your lives, you know, sort of really, you know, looking out for these issues of social justice, how does it feel that the fight is continuing?
Well, we were talking, you know, I heard President Obama constantly, really, in the last, I guess he's worried about something, about peaceful transition, that the thing about that's important to remember is that in this country, we've always had a history of peaceful transition. And in fact, at least in my lifetime, there's never been a peaceful transition of power
That's true,
in Washington, whether it was when when Reagan got elected, or before that,
we heard Bill Nixon
got elected.
Talking about Nixon, yeah.
Yes, thousands protested Richard Nixon in Washington at his inauguration in Washington. Hundreds were arrested. True about Reagan as well, and Bush. We were in Washington at the beginning of the Bush administration where there were millions of people around the world protesting his preparedness for a war in Iraq. So the transition of power in this country has never been peaceful, in the sense that there hasn't been resistance to the policies that have tried to do what we've talked about tonight. So part of having that kind of perspective means that when hundreds of thousands of people are marching in Washington on Saturday, it'll be a continuation of the way things have always been.
Look, we helped. I think we helped end the war in Vietnam. I mean, that was a great victory. We had in the civil rights movement, we had a slogan: "Freedom is a constant struggle." So there's like never one struggle you win, and then you say, "Okay, well, we can all go home now." Unfortunately, when President Obama was elected, a lot of people thought that was it. You know, this is the post-racial era, and all this mm-hmm. stuff is behind us now. We can go home and go to sleep. And the anti-war movement, for example, folded up tent and went home for 8 years. But now we see that, if you don't protect the gains that you won, they're going to get rolled back.
Mike Klonsky, Fred Klonsky, longtime educators, activists, advocates here in Chicago, the brothers Klonsky, as we've now. That's good. I can't thank you guys enough for taking some time out tonight to talk to us, especially on Martin Luther King Day. Both of you guys have been a part of the civil rights movement and about bringing equality here to the city of Chicago and the issues that we have here in the city. I appreciate it, and thank you so much for being my guest tonight.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.